Forensic Psychology is a podcast that provides an illuminating window into the workings of the criminal mind. Now, here's your host, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome back, folks. We have one of my favorite guests. We've had him. This is our third time. It's Alan Shabaro, former Green Beret. He was in the military for almost a decade, 5 years as a Green Beret. He's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, a black belt in judo. It took over 4 years, I think, of wrestling. We're going to find out more about that in a little bit as well. We're going to be talking about self-defense, some of his days in the military. We're going to talk about his programs. You can find more about him at combatbasetexas.com. combatbasetexas.com. He offers all kinds of classes there. He has classes for jiu-jitsu, judo, wrestling, fitness. He also has no gi, which I really like. Some studios are starting to do that. He's one of those studios. And that's really something we're going to be talking about today, more about street fighting as well, and how relevant is judo and jiu-jitsu for that, and wrestling, actually. So before we get started, you know what to do, folks. Make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know, we like it. Let's not waste any more time. Welcome to the show, Alan Shabaro. Welcome back, my friend.
Thank you, sir. Always a pleasure to be.
Yeah, it's always great to have you back. And it's, like I said, I was talking earlier before the show, where I was talking about judo, and as I started doing more and more research about urban combatives and self-defense, and I really realized how much judo could play a big role for people, but it just kind of always under the radar. Nobody seems to pick it up. But what I want to start off with you is, I know, just a little background. You said you started off with jiu-jitsu first. No, what did you start off with? Wrestling, jiu-jitsu, or judo first?
So I started with jiu-jitsu first. After it was like a whole slew of different ones that I was trying to find which martial art worked for me. But as I continued and trial and error, one thing would fail. I just move on to the next. And jiu-jitsu was the one thing for the time, type of body that I had. I was 145 pounds, didn't know anything else, didn't have strength or speed. But as long as I could understand the concepts of the movements, it started to sink in really quick. And it was very applicable to, you know, reality. So it wasn't like a lot of flash and kicks. So it's very, unless you're watching highlights, it's kind of boring. I'll be honest, because it's so there's so much detail, there's so many, you know, intricate movements, that if you're watching like high level, it's not really big movements, and so it doesn't catch the eye, so it kind of seems that way. But jiu-jitsu, and then when I started competing in jiu-jitsu, I started realizing I need to learn how to take people down, and that's when I started in wrestling, just for jiu-jitsu. So I never wrestled in high school. I don't even know the wrestling rules. So that's where I got into the wrestling, was for jiu-jitsu.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I have a family member now, he's about five, and he's doing jiu-jitsu now for about a year. And he's doing very, very well. But you mentioned the boring component of it, if you're watching it, and you're right, it's kind of like baseball, reminds me. I'm a big baseball fan, and nobody likes to watch baseball with me. But what I learned over the time is that they don't understand the intricacies of baseball. Once you start figuring out what that runner's looking for on first base, what the catcher's looking for, and they realize there's a game that you can't see on the surface, there's so much else going on, then they start getting more into it. And I found myself doing the same thing with jiu-jitsu. So I started realizing, why is he putting his hand there? What is this movement over here? Then I started getting really into it and realizing, wow, there's much more to this. I'm just not knowledgeable enough to know.
There is. I mean, to the point where, and this is one of the reasons why I've been in this as long as I have, is it's a, no matter how long you've been doing it, there's something always new. It's always evolving. And it could be as simple as moving your elbow 3 inches to the left over his knee, you know, pushing down instead of pulling. And that'll change the entire series of techniques that follow after that. So you're right. There's a lot of different things that are out there that if people understood the true intricacies involved, would probably change their mind on it.
Absolutely. I think so. It's funny because you mentioned that little grabs, the way you grab with your hand, if you wrap your thumb around, if you do the little monkey grab. I mean, it's just, I'm looking at that going, I never saw that before. And it's, wow, now I get it. Now, what got you into judo, though?
So I was doing really well with the takedowns for competition in jiu-jitsu with just a wrestling background. I took the time to develop a gi version of wrestling for jiu-jitsu, utilizing the gi to snap down instead of using behind the neck, grabbing onto the gi sleeve to stuff the arm instead of grabbing the wrist. So I just took the fundamentals of wrestling and applied it to jiu-jitsu, and it worked phenomenal. Until I met up with a guy in finals in the 2013 Pan Ams, and I lost by referee's decision. So that's probably one of the most disappointing ways to lose. And he literally shut down my entire game, my whole stand-up game, which has never happened to me, just using judo grips and judo control with the sleeve, because that's one of the most paramount things to establish is your grips. So he was really good at it. Locked him down every time I was trying to like shoot in. He would just have control of the lapel or the sleeve, and I couldn't get a grip. I couldn't get an angle, and it was just frustrating. So literally, I don't even think I got my medal yet. I was still kind of like in the waiting, and I called a friend of mine. I'm like, hey man, I need to get with you to start some judo, man. This And I told him what happened. I was like, this is never going to happen again. And that's how it started. And I just continued going. And one thing led to the next, and it just became addictive. And I really enjoyed the sport. And before I knew it, I started competing in it. And I'm still doing it.
I know. I think you said you're competing at what world next coming up?
September 7th, I'll be in Poland in Krakow to compete in the IJF World Championships, Veterans World Championships.
Wow. You know, it's interesting that I talked to a wrestler a couple of days ago, I think, and we were talking about wrestling, jiu-jitsu, and judo. And he found it really easy to go from jiu-jitsu to judo. He found that it was really easy to transition. He found the moves really simple to do, the tosses. Did you find the same thing?
In certain aspects, yes. So if you're taking judo and placing it just for the use of jiu-jitsu, it is a very, very smooth and simple transition. If you have the right instructor to kind of guide you through that. But keeping in mind, they're two different sports. So what you're taking from judo and applying it to jiu-jitsu, and if you try to take what you've learned and apply it back into judo, it might be illegal. Or you might find yourself in a very difficult predicament, landing wrong or turning wrong, which might not be the case in jiu-jitsu, but is in judo. One of the most common ones is you can get pinned in judo. So if you pin someone down they just recently changed the rules this year, but I think it's still 25 seconds or 20 seconds. Don't quote me on that. Then you can actually win by ippon, by pin. In jiu-jitsu, that doesn't exist. So a lot of the judokas, they roll over to their belly, which in jiu-jitsu, that is like unheard of. You don't do that ever. So they're always the one thing to keep in mind. Yes, they can definitely benefit both sports, absolutely, but they need, if you're going to train in the, it doesn't mean it's going to translate to the other sport. You have to train that rule set.
That's interesting. I know, again, like my family member who's five, I'm looking at wondering how much of a benefit judo would be for him. You know, I'm thinking just being able to get the throws down, ignoring everything else on the ground, maybe working on that. Because you were under Machado, weren't you?
Yes. I got my black belt from Carlos Machado in 2004.
Okay. I wanted to make sure people understood that too, because sometimes people who are more familiar with jiu-jitsu will definitely recognize the names like Machado and Hefero and Gracie and so forth. I think now you got, what is it, some of the new guys on the block too, the Mendez brothers. I think they're kind of, they've been around for a little while.
They've been around for a while, very well established. They're kind of, I never met them, but from what I understand, they're kind of like the Ritz-Carlton type jiu-jitsu academies. They're don't get me wrong, they're beautiful, but they literally look like art galleries. And I think it's by design. So it's literally like an art for an art type thing. But yeah, they've been around for a while. Phenomenal jiu-jitsu, very applicable. I think he's a 5 or 6-time world champion. Both of them are phenomenal.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think I've crossed by their studio a couple of times, and it's it's a good point. Way to put it. Ritz-Carlton's the nicest one I've ever seen. Let me ask you this then. In the wrestling, how was wrestling for you in jiu-jitsu? My brother showed me a video a while back ago of Mark Schultz, the champion wrestler, when going against Hickson Gracie. Well, actually, not a video. It was a conversation they were having. Well, nobody's got that video. Every time I see a video, everybody freaks out. Where's the video? But it was a conversation between them, and Hickson claims that was his most difficult opponent ever was Mark Schultz. When you hear the story, you kind of think, wow, if this guy just knew a few submissions, I think Hickson might have been in big trouble, because this guy seemed to give him a lot of work. How was it for you to go from, to mix those two together, jiu-jitsu and wrestling? Did you find it helped? It complemented?
I never competed in wrestling, so I don't know to, I've never experienced that high level or just kind of isolating wrestling. It always was wrestling for jiu-jitsu. The coaches that I had, there were two brothers. One of them was a 2-time Iranian national champion in Greco-Roman, and his brother was, I think, a 2- or 3-time national champion in freestyle. Both from Iran. Phenomenal wrestlers. I mean, incredible. And because they both did jiu-jitsu, they were able to kind of like cherry pick the things that worked, especially, you know, starting to, having like a very baseline, double leg, single leg, heel picks, snaps, things like that. And incorporate that for jiu-jitsu, like how you're going to land, the dangers that fall along with it too is, like, for example, a double leg or even a single leg, a high crotch single leg, when you're going on the inside and your head is down, especially with a gi on, is very high possibility for a choke, because you're literally kind of bringing your head right to where it needs to be. So if the person has experience, especially with wrestlers, and can identify a wrestler, that probability goes up way higher. But again, there's small things that you can do to adapt wrestling to jiu-jitsu to avoid those pitfalls. So all in all, I mean, wrestling is a phenomenal combination to have with jiu-jitsu, whether gi or no gi, both.
What do you think are the strengths from all from three? And this might be a difficult question to answer, but what are the strengths you think, if you could highlight them? Is it the takedowns from the wrestling, the flips and the throws from judo, the submissions and the whole? What do you think are some of the highlights of each one? You say, yeah, if you put all these together, you got yourself one nasty person.
So you're right. That is a bit tricky. Wrestling is the sport of grappling without cloth. Judo is the art of takedowns with cloth. Now, wrestling has submissions, not that they're legal, but they're kind of hidden in there, and you can tap people out if you wanted to. But it's primarily for getting to a position. That's the end game. For judo and jiu-jitsu, the end game for sport competitive jiu-jitsu is there's two things, submission or points. So the main goal is submission. Secondary is points. In judo, there's three ways of winning. You can win by ippon, by a perfect throw. You can win by pin, or you can win by submission. So they each have different goals, some fewer, some more. But the main focus is in wrestling to get the person down in a position where you can dominate and hold them in that position. For jiu-jitsu is manipulating the technique to get the advantage by being able to apply a submission, regardless of what position, upside down, on top, bottom. That's the beauty of it. Judo is has three different ways of winning, but the main primary focus of judo is in the throws. Not to say that you can win either way, but primarily it is the throw. And I mean by either way, as in submission, pin, or throw.
Okay. And I guess we'll actually remind everybody again, we're talking to Alan Shebaro, S-H-E-B-A-R-O. You can find more information about him at combatbasetexas.com. It's combatbasetexas.com. He has classes there for jiu-jitsu, judo, wrestling, and fitness. Check out the schedule online. He's got it all there. If you're around that neighborhood or you're visiting, great place to stop by. Okay, now I'm going to take it away from the competitive world for a minute. Actually, no, before we do that, because again, we're going to head right to the self-defense in a second. But before we do that, if you have somebody coming to see you, I guess you're going to have to ask them which ones they want to do. And do you have a recommendation depending on the person's experience level, age, physicality, anything like that? What are you looking for in the client?
Be coachable. Everything else I can deal with. So if you're coachable, and I have people that come in with wrestling backgrounds, judo backgrounds, no background. Now, there's going to be their advantage to soul three. I've actually seen someone has no background, pick up the sport and just do phenomenal along the way. No background, just as fast as the wrestler or the judo guy. Because sometimes the wrestler will be hanging on to what he's done for the longest time, which in this sport or in this art will get you in trouble. And the same thing with judo. See a lot of judokas, they roll over in their belly. You know, they have to break themselves of that habit. They keep thinking they're going to get pinned. They're going to get pinned. So they roll over. So I only say bad habit because it's not that sport. So they maintain those bad habits in a different sport that they're trying to succeed in. So that's when it actually doesn't work for you, when you have to kind of let things go. Because it is a skill set that's very, very similar. I mean, it's just different techniques. They're both on the ground. They both have to do with pulling and gripping. They both have to do with takedowns, judo and wrestling. But there is a monumental difference when you're trying to take that and apply it to a different sport.
You know, you remind me of something now with the pulling and pushing kind of thing. I know in jiu-jitsu, a lot of it, they also bait you. And I've seen wrestling bait you as well. They kind of fake, they're going to grab the one leg. So you put the other leg out, then they grab that instead. Does judo have any kind of baiting like that? I can't remember.
Oh, it's all about the sell. You'll hear that all the time. That's how you get your best throws. Hands down. In the judo realm, the setup is called kazushi. And it's basically getting them off balance, getting them prepped for a throw. And you get that with the deception of movements, whether it's raising up your leg in their direction and then last minute turning your back so you can pick them up over your back. The one I do the most is I fake that I'm trying to bring them forward with a forward throw, and I'll sell it so hard that I'm almost doing it, but I know he's recovering. And then on the second time or the third attempt, I'll change directions and go backwards. And they end up going, helping me out with it because they think I'm going forward again.
It's classics. I watch it. I have to pay attention more to the judo fights and see how that's operating. Cause I know I see it a lot with the wrestling and the jiu-jitsu fights. Now we'll take it over. I guess I'll try to portray this sometimes like his clients coming to visit you for the first time. So if somebody comes, we'll say me, I'm 50 years old. I come there, love to go there actually, but I come there and I say, hey, Alan, I wanted something for self-defense. I'm not looking to get a belt in jiu-jitsu or judo or whatever, but I'm looking to learn how to defend myself. What would you recommend and where do we start?
If that's all information I have, then I'd say initially start with jiu-jitsu. That is the most unknown of all three. Now, not to say that judo or wrestling don't offer the same benefits, but the most complex or unknown, I guess, and seems complex when you've never done it, is movements on the ground. I mean, if you think about it, from the time that you learn how to walk, you are discouraged from being on the ground anymore. You know, you 6, 7 years old, what are you doing playing on the ground? Get up, you're getting so dirty. And now when the guys come in, I'm literally telling you, for hours in a day, you're just going to be on the ground. And there's a whole new world that you have to get used to. And just how to move on the grounds, how to spin, how to rotate, how to get the leverage, where to move your hips. Oh, the hips. People don't realize how many angles they can create on the ground until they've actually experienced it and have gone through it a little bit and start to explore it for themselves. Because it's not, it looks very foreign. It looks very, I keep saying complex, but it looks almost confusing because you don't know where, and it goes against, you know, your basic logic and understanding of, well, I'm trying to get him here. Why isn't he moving? Because he moved down, but then he's going to move down and I need to move up. I'm like, yes, but he's going to react. So you have to go through the explanation and then they get it. And once they experience it, they're like, they have all these aha moments. And those are the parts I call them Miyagi moments. Those are the ones that I live for. I love seeing people go through those.
Miyagi moments. I think yesterday was the debut of Karate Kid 2, 1986. Came out yesterday. Oh. Yeah, you believe that? 36 years ago. You know, it's interesting. Again, I know, folks, if you already are taking this, we'll get to more advanced stuff in a little bit as we're going to apply it to the streets. But right now, I know there's some people out there who may not have taken it or wondering what they should do. But Alan, if you get somebody who's brand new, what are some of the challenges? I know sometimes people I've heard, they're not used to having other people up on top of them and trying to move them around. They don't know. It's kind of funny. It's almost like a dad with a child. And I don't mean this in a demeaning way in any way, but when a dad plays roughhouse with the little ones, whether they're 4 or 5 or 6 years old, the child's learning what they can and can't do, right? They know how hard to hit them, how hard to grab them. And they start learning aggression control, I guess you can say. But even as adults in jiu-jitsu, it seems like the same thing because you know how hard you want to pull somebody or how much you should apply a choke or anything like that. What are some of the things you see there that are challenging for newcomers?
The one example that I give that everyone can relate to is think about taking a nervous, inexperienced teenager driving for the first time on the highway.
That's not a good start.
and you know, a little bit of hydroplaning. When they're new, everything is almost exaggerated. So, you know, when they slam on the brakes and when they hit the gas and then when they turn the steering wheel, it's just mostly overdone. I rarely see people underpowering their movements, but because they don't, and it's not their fault. And I don't mean to pick on the bigger guys, but this is the reason why in my academy, and there's a lot of different places that have this as well. I have white and blue belt female athletes are not allowed to roll with male white belts. So the reason for that is that if I have a male that's 230 pounds, has no experience, and I put him against even a male white belt that's a third of the size, I mean, 130 pounds, 120 pounds, that person that's bigger doesn't have the technique, so they're going to make it up with strength. Power, if they have the speed, they're going to try to utilize that in the situation because that's all they have. the most common phrase you're going to hear, and you can pretty much, this is echoing across every academy, relax, because once you relax, you can actually see what you're doing. Things slow down, you can see the movements, you can see how the weight shifts and where you need to balance them out and how to pull and where to pull, when to push, when to elevate, when to push back, when to sink your hips in, so forth. You have that time to actually see it, but it takes a while. It's not something that comes automatic because it's not instinctual. Being on your feet because you've been on your feet is instinctual. Utilizing your feet as your hands or as hooks, as ways to grab a leg and move it. I mean, people ignore that half of their body for usually the first year, for the most part, just because, I mean, if you think about it, you always want to use your hands. So you bend over at the waist. In jiu-jitsu, a general rule is once your head goes below your hips, bad things are about to happen. So they're much easier to get in submissions. They're much easier to get off balance. But that in itself, you understand the general principles. Once they actually have an understanding of those concepts, it's almost like they got supercharged in their journey in this. So all of a sudden now things are easier. They understand this. But when you're first starting, you don't have that. You don't have even a concept. So when that person has, for example, the hydroplaning, you know, okay, small movement here, small movement right. Okay, I got it fixed. We're good. Versus, oh, crap, I'm sliding. Let me jerk the steering wheel three times to the right. Oh, crap, they're coming three times to the left. That's the best way of kind of explaining it. And it's not their fault. That's all they know.
How often would you recommend them going to the studio to train with you, somebody novice like that?
What is your goal? Okay. I hate answering the question with a question, but what is the goal?
We'll say somebody who wants to learn how to defend themselves, get better at jiu-jitsu. That's pretty much it. I mean, I guess they're not looking to be a black belt or anything. I know it's kind of difficult. It's like a personal trainer. What's your goal? That's what makes it complicated if I don't give you a goal. How about that one? Just somebody who wants to learn how to defend themselves pretty well on the ground, maybe be able to take some people down. Mm-hmm. How long would that be? What would you recommend there?
How much you should train? I always suggest starting out with twice a week. Mm-hmm. Once you get in a habit of twice a week and you make that regular, you can pretty much differentiate whether it's going to be better for you to go another day, especially because age does play a factor. Your recovery plays a factor, your injuries, you know, and just like anything else, most thing that people actually experience in jiu-jitsu is realizing how rigid they are and how horrible their flexibility is and how horrible their mobility is. So once you actually realize that, don't just ignore it. Actually start, you know, increasing your mobility, you know, start doing that before classes, after classes. Just take 7 to 10 minutes and you'll sleep better too. So it's actually a handstand. I'd started doing that and it works. But listen to your body. If you're one of those guys that goes in there and you give 100% every night, you're going to need to recover. You have to. Or not, you're just, your performance will be worse the next day and you think you'll be able to do things. But you don't have the strength that you normally do. And that's usually when injuries happen. So don't overdo it. You'll see eventually once you kind of like get hooked, if you get hooked, it's a lifelong thing. So it doesn't matter if you're, you know, it takes you 10 years or 15 years, you keep doing it, you're going to be a black belt. So the only thing you really have to focus on is just your training and let the time go.
It's kind of funny you mentioned that because I have heard people say that before where they started taking it and they said, I'm just going to take it for a month or two. And all of a sudden it's 4 years later. They can't stop. And I guess it goes back to your point originally where it's just, there's just so much to learn. Mm-hmm. You just can't learn it all in one day. Let me ask you, go ahead.
I'm sorry. So you have the highest amount, like if you can make it past blue belt, you're usually in for life.
Oh, really? But
Yeah, you have a lot of the, blue belt missing persons. When I started, it made sense. I could understand it. When I started, there wasn't much jiu-jitsu in the U.S. at all. So if you just had a blue belt, it was enough for you to open up an academy. You could legitimately open a place up just with a blue belt because, I mean, you have like 2 years experience versus people who have zero. The problem was a lot of these places stopped training in just a blue belt. So by the time their students got up to their level, they had a wall. You had other places that there were blue belt, but they were still training. So by the time the students were blue belts, they were purple belts. By the time they were purple belts, he was a brown belt. So it was totally fine. But usually if you can make it past blue belt, you're in. You're going to be there for life.
You think it's true, because I've heard this before. If you get a blue belt already, you can handle most people who have no experience at all. So if you get into a fight somewhere, you should be able to take care of that individual much better than you did before. Is that fair? Not a competition, though, just a street fight or something like that.
So many variables. It's hard to say. For the most, I'd say yes. But I would say probably about 75 to 80%, you'll be able to handle.
Okay. Yeah. And I know that you're right. It's complicated. It depends on the level of blue belt the person is and height, weight, and everything else.
On the day, it depends on the environment. Are you in, are you fighting in an elevator? Are you fighting in an open space? Are you fighting where there's a lot of furniture? Because keep in mind, if you're training jiu-jitsu, your primary is to get on the ground. Well, if you get pinned up against a wall, you'll never make it to the ground. So it doesn't work for every environment unless you've trained with every environment. So I don't like to say, yes, it'll work in every environment. You don't have to train every environment. It'll just work is completely false.
That's a great segue into our other part now. As we go into street fighting, I guess, people who encounter an issue go into, things can happen anywhere, bars, any individual who maybe has some issues all of a sudden starts to pick a fight on. I think I just saw a video the other day, Beverly Hills, or somebody who just picked a fight with a guy for no apparent reason. And it was really bizarre. I think it was transient. So I'm assuming he might've been on something. I don't know. He ends up picking up a fight with the guy, but the guy keeps backpedaling, trying to get away from him, which I was kind of surprised why he just didn't run. Because there's no way the other guy was catching him. And they ended up squaring off, and then they ended up getting into a fisticuffs. And the victim ended up going to the ground because the transient was able to punch him. But it's interesting, too, because I see a lot of haymakers that fly in street fights, too. So I guess I'm asking you that then. So before we get to the ground, what do you think about judo as a defense for streets? I've heard couple of things. I've heard great things about it, and then I'll throw you the negative too and see what you say as well. The negative is usually sometimes, hey, you flip him too hard, you'll crack his neck. I mean, you'll crack his head open if you hit him on the concrete, so things like that. I guess it also depends on the situation, but what are your thoughts about judo and the street?
I would highly recommend it. I think it's a phenomenal skill set to have for everyday self-defense. That would be the only one that I would say, if you're not going to do jiu-jitsu, do judo. And it's nothing against wrestling. It's just in wrestling, it's the art of grappling without cloth and self-defense. And this is a point that, I bring up, in no-gi versus gi, what you're wearing right now, right? Is the most common attire. You're wearing pants. You're wearing a shirt. Northeast, you're wearing a jacket. You have a belt on. So the gi was actually created as clothing that wouldn't rip every time you trained. So it literally is just a way of training to assimilate the everyday environment that you're in. People kind of mistake that because it looks like a uniform. It's changed over time. But if you look at the original gis, they weren't much different than traditional kimonos. And hence why it was just the same name and it just turned into a gi later on. But it's traditionally still called the kimono. But it's just thicker. So you don't rip your shirts every time you go into train. So for reality wise, judo, I think, is a lot more beneficial in that sense, because you're learning how to manipulate their clothing to your advantage for the setups, for the throws that you're trying to do.
It's interesting because I know a lot of people will grab your clothes if they're trying to start something, and that usually puts you right in their wheelhouse, right?
Yes. And within, you know, because you have to have that closing of the distance. And once you get a grip, you know, the spacing, you know, it goes right into your world. Yes.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned a minute ago about context or the environment around you. What limitations does judo have?
Same. For example, in a crowded area, like for example, if it was in an elevator, you don't have the space to throw. Now you can use some of the techniques to pin them against the wall. But your primary and most dominant skill set that you have from judo is eliminated. Let's see what else. Slippery. Anything that's slippery, pretty much gone as well. Not to say anything. I say gone. I mean, there are some things that you can do, but you're drastically limited.
So in the rain, very complicated in the rain.
It depends on your footing. So, I mean, if your footing is, you can still grip your feet because you need to be able to pivot, lift, you know, and quick movements. So that could be a huge factor. And it also depends on, for example, like furniture. So, I mean, breaking someone's neck, you know, being thrown is a reality. If you actually know judo, that you're actually throwing them on their back. Very, very rarely. I've been doing judo for 7 years now, and I've never been thrown on my head. I think the closest I've gone is my shoulder. But the way the throws are developed in order to get the maximum efficiency, you're rolling your body over as to get them on their back, because that's the point of the sport, is to throw them on their back. In a training environment for judo, if you throw them on the neck, you're eliminating your training partner. So you can also get disqualified for spiking. So you're not actually supposed to throw them on their head. Now, does it happen? Yeah. But I've also seen guys countering throws by literally, instead of their back hitting, they'll bounce off their head and then land back on their feet. They're incredible acrobats. I'd say like the lower divisions, like in the 60, 70 kilo range, you'll see some crazy acrobatics in their game.
Oh, wow. Now, I'm going to put you back into this situation, because I just saw this happened last week, I think, in Southern California, where a woman went into an elevator. The man came out of the elevator, decided to go back in the elevator and sexually assault her. What are the, if any of these three would be the best, or is there something else you would recommend for that person? Because at that point, like you said, you don't have a lot of space.
And even jiu-jitsu in itself, for that situation, I would highly recommend jiu-jitsu. For women, I would highly recommend, if you're only going to pick one, do jiu-jitsu. Because the most attacked, my data is a decade old. But the stats that I got from like 2010, 2011, were they're sexually assaulted on the ground. Knowing how to move on the ground to prevent that is the primary reason why you're taking it for self-defense. So that would be it. Judo again has Nawaza, which is their form of ground fighting. But again, it's very limited, because the primary point of judo is the throw. Wrestling, I think in order to be proficient in wrestling, to use it as self-defense for women would take a lot longer time to learn. And they're not used to being on their back. So out of those three for women, I think wrestling will be third, because they don't train on their back. And jiu-jitsu, they do. Judo has Nawaza Ground Fighting Incorporated, but it's a very small amount. But jiu-jitsu, that's what it's all about. And if that's the end game that you're looking for, is to defend yourself in a situation like that, that would be it.
I guess judo might be very helpful for women as well, if they're coming from behind to try to get them as well, wouldn't it? Or
very. And again, the efficiency of any art is dependent on the practitioner. So if I train for 10 years, but train once a month, it's not really going to do you much good. If you train a couple times a week, it's enough for you to develop a skill set that's retained. If you train 5 times a week, you develop a skill set that becomes instinctual. And that's what you're, and I say 5 times a week, this is based off me. I used to train 10 to 12 times a week just because I just love the sport. I moved to do jiu-jitsu. I literally moved from where I was going to school up to Dallas so I could train with Carlos. My whole life revolved around it. So I'm a little bit on the extreme side. But I was, if it was self-defense for women, and that's what you want to become proficient at, that to make it instinctual, I would say 3 times a week.
Now, that's a good point. Staying on the female, and any guess if you're outweighed by quite a bit, I'm assuming some of them are going to start asking questions. I can't flip a guy on a judo throw if he's 220 pounds and I'm 130, 120 pounds. How am I going to flip that guy? Or jiu-jitsu, how am I going to be able to hold him down? What's your answer to that?
Angles and leverage. The whole, use his weight against them. You've heard that. There's some truth to that. It's just become like a meme tagline. But there's a lot of truth to that. And I'm one of the examples. I was 100 in my first tournament. I weighed in 147 pounds at 6'1". So I was bone thin. My nickname was Skeletor at the time. My mom was making fun of me, saying I looked like an orange with an orange on top of a toothpick. So
Skeletor is pretty buff, though. So you turned that into the modern day version of Skeletor, I guess.
Yeah, how they meant it. But the once you actually realize, like, if someone is perfect example, someone not paying attention at the edge of a pool and you just kind of tap them and they fall over, when you actually get that first throw or first submission, you realize that you're not trying to fight the whole body. You're only trying to fight in judo for the throw, one leg that always weights on, and get him off balance on that. Because his mass is, and again, it's not going after the strongest part, but it's actually going after the weakest part. So for jiu-jitsu, I'm not attacking his body. I'm attacking his elbow or his shoulder or his wrist or his knee. I'm not attacking his leg. I'm not attacking, his upper body. I'm specifically going after his neck, his shoulder, elbow, wrist, hip, knee, the joints themselves. So, and you're placing your entire body on that. So if you can imagine how much pressure it takes to start feeling pain in your elbow, I mean, it's what, 7-8 pounds before you start feeling it. So if you can imagine a woman that's 130 pounds, how much force can they generate by just bridging their hips? You see what I mean? So they could easily generate 100 pounds of force. And if they apply that to the elbow, well, it doesn't matter how big you are. You have 130 pounds versus whatever you can curl. So unless that person can curl 130 pounds on a dynamic active resistance, then that's very rare. And we're also talking like worst case scenario, right? So it also plays with variables.
How important is it for a woman? Then let's say a woman goes to your studio, or you, if not in Texas, if they have to go somewhere else. Again, folks, talking to Alan Shabaro at combatbasedtexas.com. If you have somebody, a woman who's at 125, 130, after they get to a certain degree, would you match her up with a blue belt or higher male so she gets used to dealing with somebody who's heavier, who's stronger, to be able to work that, or no?
I don't have to. They usually target them. once they start developing that confidence, it's kind of crazy. But once they develop that confidence, they're just like, hey, you want to go? You want to go? And they really don't care. Now I do have the ones that are kind of like so eager. They'll, hey, you know, there's a, I have a, like a 280 pound black belt. And he's 6'2". Super nice guy though. He rolls like a teddy bear. But even someone that rolls like a teddy bear, that's a black belt that knows how to move. They're always just a higher chance for injury just because of sheer size. Not that they're trying to, but if the person rolls and say they have the, he's rolling with that female and he rolls a certain way, loses footing or doesn't even realize the leg is there at a certain position and just lays down on it, it could be enough force and pressure to injure the person. So I don't want to put them in a situation where I know they're going to get injured in order for them to get the experience. I want them to get experience based off the multitude of different people. And if that situation comes up, they'll be able to rationalize and make decisions based off the skill sets they have developed.
Now, tell me a little bit about no-gi and how that would it all fit in, because it sounds like that's a pretty cool idea, especially since most of the time we're not walking around in gis, but we have gi-like clothes on, as you mentioned earlier. You can grab belt buckles and through belt buckles, but belt loops and things of that nature. Tell us about the no-gi training that you do.
So the no-gi is a necessity. You have, especially in this community, you have this whole, gi versus no-gi. You need both. I rarely, if ever, compete in no-gi. The last one I did, I think, was like 7 years ago. It's a phenomenal way. It's own sport, pretty much, even though it's still jiu-jitsu. But it doesn't have, it's closer to wrestling, a kind of family lineage in a sense, where, the wrestling background would be extremely beneficial to no-gi, for grips, control, movement. But if you take that wrestler and put a gi on them, all of a sudden it's almost like they put a straitjacket on them and they're suffocating in it. Some of the best wrestlers I've worked with, like, put this on, they're like, nope, I'm not doing that. They just do it. Because it changes the entire dynamic of the sport. So it is a necessity, because of grips. When you don't have the, if you try to grab the lapel and you miss, there's a lot of very quick decisions that you have to make in order to complete technique, especially if you have a very dynamic opponent. So being able to just as comfortably grab onto the gi, oh, he dodged that, grab onto the neck instead, or snap down the neck like wrestling, or changing the angle, getting low, keeping your head up. You know, these things are ingrained in wrestlers, ingrained in them. So taking that, you already have a really solid foundation for jiu-jitsu. So you could quickly make it up the ranks where they normally have the wall that they hit is when they start trying to play guard, which is half of the jiu-jitsu game. So that's usually when they hit their wall and they kind of like slowly build themselves up, because that was the one part that is absolutely missing. But other than that, the wrestling techniques and grips and strategies that wrestlers have can very easily be applied to no-gi.
Now, that's really fascinating, because I have noticed in watching a lot of videos and competition, especially jiu-jitsu, you're right, there's a whole different ballgame when it comes to gi or no-gi, because the gi really has become a lot of grabbing of the gi, as you mentioned a long time ago in the interview, going underneath, grabbing, pulling this, turning it around. A lot of it's using the gi. I've seen people hold on to the bottom of the pants leg of the gi to keep them from going from one spot to another. And I'm looking at that going, wow, okay, that's different. You try that with no gi, you're not getting very far unless you're wearing pants. But I guess it's still very effective on the street, because you can still grab their pants. That person's not moving anywhere if you grab the bottom part of the leg there.
But I guess also, being able to establish the so grips, and especially judo, jiu-jitsu, are absolutely paramount. If you watch high level judo, you'll see usually it's the first person that establishes grips that usually gets to win. But the other factor of it that's very realistic is the friction. So in judo or in jiu-jitsu, in the gi, when you're trying to apply an arm bar, you have the pants on your legs that are wrapping around their arm, which has a sleeve. So the uniform itself will create a bite, very difficult to slip out of. Versus in no-gi, you have to have a different type of control because there is no friction. So they'll be able to slip out of things very easily if you don't know what you're doing and how to hold properly. So, but if you take that no-gi tactic and those same situations and if you know how to do that and you apply it to gi, oh crap, it's like, you know, supercharging your game. So you have to know both. You absolutely do. I am a firm believer in that.
That's interesting. I know some people are going to say, well, wait a minute. You know, if I'm in the fight in the street, I'm going to put them in an arm bar or I'm going to choke them out. Usually you get a lot of that. But I've heard others say, you're not really looking for a submission on mm-hmm. the street. You're looking more for a restraint. What are your thoughts on that?
I hate to be difficult on this, but it would depend on the situation. If outnumbered, I'm out.
If it's what? If you're outnumbered?
If I'm outnumbered, I'm out. I'll try to make an example out of one of them so I can take off.
What happens one-on-one? The guy is drunk, takes a swing at you. Would you recommend restraint?
Yeah. Working in night industry, had a lot of situations like that. And unfortunately, most of the time people are drunk. It's usually, you know, why they're being an asshole is because they're drinking. But when I was first into that industry, those were on the same time I was fairly new at jiu-jitsu, probably like 6 years, 7 years in. And, the skill set that I had and I was applying was too much. because out of like instinct right away, choking them, and I choke them out and like, oh shit, you know, now I got to wait for them to come to. People think that I killed them, you know, so there's a crowd, and nowadays everyone's got a phone, everyone's recording. So there's a lot more into it than a controlled environment, like in sport. And you have to keep in mind, you know, being on the ground, using traditional jiu-jitsu techniques, you're trying to avoid as well, because I don't, and this is me, I don't want to be on the ground on my back. I want to be dominant on top. I want to pin them on the ground. I always want to be the guy on top, no matter what. I want to be on top, especially in street. I can be aware of other dangers that are coming and be able to do something about it. I can disengage and book if I need to. But the traditional guard game in street self-defense, I would highly advise against.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. As I continue, I've analyzed hundreds and hundreds of street fights, and you just brought up a great point. And I always ask the tough questions, and this is just complicated questions, right? What situation, like you mentioned earlier. But when I see situations one-on-one, I can see jiu-jitsu wrestling working very well, as you just mentioned now. If you're clear, nobody else is around you. But like you said, if you get two, which is that video that just came out a couple of days ago, you probably don't see it, but there's a video out there. I think he's a MMA guy or something. And these two guys were drunk and they were trying to circle him and whatnot. He couldn't take him to the ground because the other guy's going to pound on him from above. So what he did was a kick. And he ended up doing a roundhouse, I think, or something like that, knocking the one guy down, almost out. Then the other guy kind of backed off, decided, I'm not going to do anything anymore. But I guess the question to you now is, some of the ones we talked about today, judo, jiu-jitsu, wrestling, those seem to be more compromised in a situation when it's 2-on-1, 3-on-1. And I get it. If you can run is always the best thing, because you don't know if they have knives or guns or whatever else is going to happen. But if you're stuck with two, Would striking be something you offer as well to your courses or no?
So I don't offer that in my academy, but I always encourage people, if they have the time and they have the willingness to learn, absolutely Muay Thai. Because it not only incorporates striking distance, like with a boxer, but it also incorporates what boxers normally can't throw in, and utilizing knees and elbows. And the way that it's taught, if you have a good Muay Thai instructor especially, is the ability to generate so much power through your core is unbelievable. I trained with when I went to Thailand in 2002, that most of the guys were on average between 150 to 165 pounds. But I mean, they would bruise my arms holding pads, you know, when I was holding, I mean, through the pads, my arms were bruised. But also gives you that basic of that close, like an elevator fight. If you stand up, Muay Thai. Absolutely. But even a striking situation with multiple attackers, it would be probably better to have a striking knowledge, multiple attackers. But I've also seen, some videos of a guy that was on number two. I think this was in England or something. And literally threw one guy, and it was a one-on-one fight after that, because you have to keep in mind, when we throw, we're throwing thinking there's a mat. So if you throw somebody and it's not a mat, it's concrete, and they don't know how to fall, which is really important. You got to know how to fall. you could really injure them. I mean, really bad. And this guy looked, I mean, he was all folded up in a position where he looked like he was dead. I mean, his arm was kind of folded over his head, and he was kind of looking into the distance. I mean, just from his body position, he was not moving. There was so much other stuff going on, but I just kept watching that guy going, is that guy dead? And he handled himself great. I mean, the other guy kind of saw what he did to the other one, didn't want any part of it. And, you know, threw a couple of haymakers just to kind of like show that, you know, that he was still in the fight. And once he missed twice, then he kind of like backed down and kind of like went back to his friend. And, you know, the video ended. So, but I've seen several situations where there was no striking involved, multiple opponents, and them doing just fine.
That's a great point. Yeah, I could see that with judo. You flip one guy hurt him, like you said, but landing on concrete, you're in, it's a whole different world than a pad. And if you don't know how to land.
And it's a lot easier to explain too. I mean, so if you have someone that's videotaped it, you know, it's very much can be explained as a defensive move. You know, they came at me and utilized that to, you know, throw them. And you can, and when you analyze a video like that, you can definitely see who the first assailant is. You know, whoever's reaching up to grab the person first. So if that guy comes at you with the intent to grab, well, and judo, you already kind of, it's called that kuzushi. And, you know, so they reach and they're already off balance. Well, that's what we're looking for in judo. So it's a perfect opportunity. But it's also great to have, if someone is recording the situation, it shows that they are the one that's, you know, with the aggressive intent.
Right into the spider's lair they went the minute they try to grab you. Bad news. Again, folks, we're talking to Alan Shabar over at combatbasetexas.com. Check it out, combatbasetexas.com. I guess in our last few minutes together, as we go through this, one of the reasons I asked that is because you're right. The world changed a lot with video cameras. Liability is a bigger issue. Some states more so than others. Other states are going to have an easier chance to win on self-defense cases. Others may even say, well, wait a minute, Alan, you got a black belt. You should know better. And they start going after you on that, even though you're the victim. That's interesting. Because that makes life now more complicated. I see some areas, some states are treating civilians almost like law enforcement, where law enforcement can't punch back necessarily if the person's being held down. And today it's really similar. It's dangerous to strike.
And keep in mind, self-defense for women kind of goes into different categories. Self-defense and kind of goes a different category for kids. But also keep in mind, like, for example, jiu-jitsu, in my experience, is literally the most compassionate of all martial arts. Because if you have somebody in a strangle, or if you have somebody in an armbar or shoulder lock, you can diminish the amount of pressure that you're having. Like, hey, man, hey, talk to me. You're right. I'm going to let you up. And if he starts to squirm again, you can apply more pressure, calm him down. Hey, slow down, bud. You know, I'm going to let you up, but not if you're going to keep acting that way. And you can really control the situation that way. And to the point where you can actually have them being a very focused listener. They will comply a lot better, realizing that they're in a bad spot. They know they're not going to get out. And they kind of realize, okay, he's letting me up. I'm good. And I've managed to squash a lot of different conflicts like that. Just like, man, I'm going to let you up. Let's talk about this. Okay. Just chill out. And almost always they try to take that opportunity to try to squirm out of it real fast. And I'm like, all right, now you're going to calm down. Okay. Let you up. All right. You good? All right. Now what's the problem? And then it develops from there. Kind of like what you're saying, you know, the different standard. And I used to think about that a lot. I don't really think about that much now. Mainly because I've trained so much. And I do this all the time. And not to sound, you know, arrogant in the sense, but I get paid to do this. Why do I want to waste my time with this guy that's mouthing off? You know, so it's so easy for me to walk away when someone's yelling, you know, trying to be confrontational, and just in mid-sentence, I just turn around and walk. To me, it's just not worth it. And a lot of the people that I hear a lot of stories from some of my guys, the last one most recently was about 3 months ago, saying that, yeah, they were coming out of a club, they were going to grab something to eat. And, you know, there were some other people at the, you know, that were drunk, that were at the same restaurant outside, and they were trying to, you know, confront him, and he just kind of just nodded his head, just walked away, you know. And I thought that was phenomenal, because he had developed his confidence so much, realizing, like, you know what, I'm going to lose no matter what I do. If I get in a fight with this guy and I whoop his ass, I'm going to get arrested. I'm going to have to deal with that. And the other side, well, if I get into it, something happens that I'm not aware of, I'm going to get my ass whooped. So it's a lose-lose no matter what. So why would you want to put yourself in that position?
You're absolutely right. The best defense I always think is run away, get out of there. Don't sit around if you can. You really don't know what's going to happen. You really don't. That's a great point. I guess my last question, this is kind of a conversation. Oops, sorry.
Both ways. So you don't know what's going to happen, because let's say your judo is that effective and you hurt the guy. You see what I mean? So yeah, it was defense, but you're like, well, why did you do it so hard? I'm like, well, I didn't. He just came at me that hard, you know, but you're going to have to explain that. So it's not worth it.
Financial cost isn't worth it. And you know, the interesting thing, Alan, is if I saw this the other day, somebody was fighting, I forgot what he did. I think he punched the guy. The guy fell down, hit his head on the sidewalk or something like that. The story you always hear people tell you about, and this actually happened, the guy ended up dying. And now you have to deal with that in court. But also the part people don't talk about is the psychological part. You just killed somebody and you weren't trying to, even though you're in self-defense, that still gets to some people for sure.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you this question as we wrap up here. This one made me think as you were talking. I interviewed a couple of guys over the last few weeks on a very difficult topic, which was human trafficking and child exploitation and kidnapping. We know that most kidnappings are usually done by a family member, usually parents, custody issues, about 80% or something like that. They're pretty high, but the ones with the strangers. So I guess my question is, if you have a 10 or 11 or 12 year old and they have an adult who's trying to take them, which defense, which self-defense would you recommend, if any? And I guess, and I'll ask you the next question after that, I guess. It's a tough one, I know.
Yeah, because I'm of the belief that, especially with kids, women and kids especially, but men as well, is preventive versus reactionary. So I don't teach women self-defense. I don't have like a course for that. I don't teach weekend seminars. I'm actually a big believer against that. And I mean like those 2-day courses. And the reason being, and I catch a lot of shit for this. But the reason being is that there is no skill set that you can have under an emergency that you can possess only after training it for 3-4 hours. And it's not even, you're not even familiarized with it. But what ends up happening is you end up recollecting some of the techniques. You end up trying to pause to remember them, or you put yourself in a worse situation because you thought that was what you're supposed to do because you were not even proficient at it. It's a huge thing, especially in the market. You hear this all the time. This martial art you can learn and, you know, you do it for 6 hours and, or 1 weekend or whatever it is. And you'll remember for the rest of your life and it'll be instinct and that is absolute horseshit. I've actually tried to find as much data as I could on that before I actually started speaking up about this. And I couldn't find much, but the stuff that I did find definitely shows that, the ability to prevent something is much greater. The course that I teach for women is actually a situational awareness. So I teach them like what makes them a target. I got so much data on that. Violent crimes, stats in prisons. They literally asked a question, showed them a video of it was like a really crowded supermarket parking lot. And they showed the same clip to, I think it was like 237 violent criminals. And out of that, they said, which person would you target? And it was overwhelming amount. I think it was like 92% picked the same people. And when they asked why, it was a very simple response. They looked like a victim. So, and once I kind of read that, I started developing the program off of that. And what made them look like a victim, their posture, you know, the way that they're, you know, you see this all the time. People coming out of the grocery store, right? They don't even know where their car is parked because they're looking at their phone. They're hunched over, down, you know, their shoulders are rolled it in. You know, they it's a very passive and submissive type posture that they're giving off. And a lot of people aren't even aware of this. The biggest pet peeve, I don't know how common this is in the Northeast, but we have a lot of these families that have those stick figure families, stickers on the car. And I just cringe. And every time I do these seminars, I always go to the parking lot and I just quickly gather information on these stick figures. And so usually at the end of the seminar, I'm like, so everyone kind of understand what we're doing. And I tell them, okay, so in 5 minutes in the parking lot, I was able to gain this much information. So who's driving the blue van? Okay, so I'm going to follow you one day. I'm going to know exactly who your kid is. And I'm going to know if I wanted to go back the next day, I can say, hey, because you had a stick figure of daddy named Mark with a golf club, mommy with a doing like a yoga pose named Susie. And then, you know, your kid, you know, whatever, Jacob, and, you know, your brother, and then your cat Moon. So I could easily just go up and keep in mind if 5 or 6 year old, I just follow them. I know who they are. The next day I go there before she goes to pick them up and say, hey, Moon is in the vet, got hit by a car. Your dad's at the golf course and your mom's doing yoga and you know them all by name. Why wouldn't the kid go with you?
Good point.
And when they start realizing how much damage a small thing like that does, then they can start understanding, okay, I need to be, it kind of opens their eyes of the things that they just weren't aware to. Things like stair stepping when they're being followed. It's not something that is like super, you know, you see the spy movies all the time, but, and yes, originally I did get it from a surveillance and counter-surveillance course, but, you know, stair-stepping when you're driving is literally something that you can do every day. And the example that I always like to throw, there was a woman in Plano here in Texas, the year that I moved back, her ex-husband, or this lady, got a divorce, moved, changed jobs, everything. He ended up finding out where she was at and literally just tailed her. And she took the same route every night. And he did that for about a week. One day she just didn't come home. No one realized it. But she took this exact same route, left the exact same time. It was so predictable. So I'm not saying rearrange, you know, your entire life around that, but why not just offer, or not offer, but explore, you know, three or four different ways to get home. And before you know it, you know, you'll be more familiarized with it. I especially try to encourage this type of mentality with teenagers when they're first kind of getting this, knowing your environment. How far is the police station? How far is the hospital? Do you know how to get there? Between your home and work, that just from there, that's all you need to know. If you feel that someone's following you, how do you know? You know, are you keeping in mind this, or are you on your phone when you're driving? You know, these things like that are very simplistic and can be trained every single day. Well, you don't have to take a class. You just have to be aware. But to be aware, you have to stop doing the things that your comfort tells you to do. My phone vibrates. I need to check it. Well, you don't need to check it. You need to check your rearview mirror. So these are the things that you're battling to try to get them to realize how simplistic certain things can be, but how difficult they can to break habit in order to have something as important as situational awareness or understanding situational awareness.
Man, you hit a lot of great points. It's interesting because I know disinformation is the biggest thing we see, and society is to blame. There's a lot of, we see a lot of that, how would you say, drive-through mentality for a lot of industries, not just self-defense. You take 2-day course for this, but you take a day course for the guns, you take a day course for this, take a for that. Everything is just quick. Watch a 2-minute video and you can do it too, kind of thing. And what?
Instant gratification.
Exactly. And it's really overwhelming society. I just wonder how much longer. I'm hoping more and more people, I am starting to see it in certain industries where more and more people are actually going to the pros and then realizing, okay, I wasted $100 for that 2-hour course because it didn't teach me anything now that I'm here and with a professional learning how to do this. Because I've heard those comments every so often. So hopefully those will start growing when people start doing those things and realize, no, you need a lot more time commitment for some of these things. Not years, but a lot more than 2 days or 2 hours. The other thing you made an interesting point too is changing up your routines, as you mentioned, and the adolescents as well, getting ready to be able to defend themselves, which is something in today's world that we need to be really careful with. And you, in your place, Combat Base Texas, you work with all ages or?
Start at 5.
Start at 5, okay. That's pretty low. That's about as low as you can go.
We actually have the next one coming. We have a situational awareness for kids as well. And it's instead of doing jujitsu, we go over things like, how do you get out of a trunk? How do put out? These are very realistic things that, unfortunately, I do have to get a waiver signed by the parents for them to participate in. And I do prefer the parents be there, especially for the trunk, because it seems like almost archaic, you know, in mentality. Like, why would you? Well, because you don't want your kid to be there for the first time trying to figure it out, you know, if that happens. You know, how to, you know, put on a tourniquet. If, and without getting into politics, with the amount of gun problems that we're having, and I mean in general with the shootings, it's a very, very much higher chance, probability that you're going to have that skill set at some point in time of your life. And so why wouldn't you want to have your 10 or 12 year old that's physically and mentally mature enough to be able to handle a situation? Why not develop that skill set now? So if it's ever needed for the parent or for them later on, they know how. And we're just talking very basic things, but still get the same response with the high eyebrows going, what? You want to do what? But once they, I kind of explain the situation, most, well, I think all the parents have been on board.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because psychologically, it's so different when it's the first time. That's not the time you want it. Like, I think I've had this conversation with some other people before on self-defense. I had to phrase this carefully. I just remember the first time I ever got punched. It knocks you for a loop for a second. You're thrown off. And I always tell people, that's one of the benefits you get for the first time if you ever get punched, is to kind of feel it. I'm not saying get hit by Tyson, but when you get tagged, it startles you. Because I remember when I got hit the first time, like years ago, I just kind of stood there thinking, what the hell was that? And then he tagged me again and tagged me again. It was my coach. And then I thought, and he starts yelling at me, you better fight back. You're going to keep getting tagged. And then finally I started punching back. And then I realized after a while, okay, not big deal. I can keep getting tagged and keep moving along. But that very first time, it's not the time you want. It's not the street when you get tagged, because then all of a sudden all hell breaks loose for you.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily, and that's such a great point. I've seen that in the military. You have a person that has a high amount of training but never been in the situation, no experience in that environment. That shot goes off, and all of a sudden they kind of like just freeze into place. Like, what do I do? You know, shoot back. Okay. And then all of a sudden they snap out of it, you know, but they just, it's that break into, you know, hearing that, you know, colloquial, you know, the gun go off, you know, for like the sprinters, you know, and the same thing, it's breaking free of that, you know, so you can, you know, utilize the skill sets that you have. And a lot of people have, and this is one of those things where you have like the whole debates of competitive shooters versus people that have actually been in combat, you know, are those things still effective? Well, you talk to a lot of the pro shooters, they're like, oh, fuck no, I'm not doing that. You know, they're shooting back. That's an entire different, you know, scenario. You know, I'm shooting a paper, you know, and they because they're very open about it, very honest. No, I've never been a cop. I never had someone shoot at me. I'm sure that things would change, because right now they're just going through the course knowing they're not going to be shot at. So, and that's realistic. But it's the sport too. It's in, that's what it was designed for. It's an environment with a controlled set of rules for that, meaning for that environment. But for same thing with fighting, you know, Mike Tyson said it best, you know, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face, you know, and it holds true. You know, once you feel the reality, it sets in, and hopefully sets in for a lifetime where you're like, you know what? I need to do something about that.
No, I can't agree more. Again, folks, I highly recommend it. If you've never done any martial arts, if you've never done any fighting, not to get punched in the face, but if you go to a place to learn how to feel when somebody's on top of you, somebody's controlling you for that first time in a safe environment where you can learn how to get out of it, there's nothing like it. It's like Alan says, you don't want to experience that the first time on the streets or in a bad situation. And it also helps so much with proprioception, learning how to move yourself, as you mentioned earlier, how to move your hips and shift your weight and things of that nature. You get so much more in tune with your body and yourself as well. I guess my last question for you, Alan, before we wrap up, is fitness. Anything you would recommend for people to, if they're going to start with you or to improve themselves with jiu-jitsu or judo, should they be running 10 miles a day? What should they do, or anything at all?
If you're going to be competitive, I would highly recommend strength training, everything that goes into it, other than jiu-jitsu, I would recommend explosive weight training, like Olympic style weightlifting, you know, high intensity training, to build your strength, to build your speed. Because in a competitive match, you're going up against someone who's your age, your weight. It's kind of like NASCAR, right? You're just trying to find the skill set that comes above everyone having the same, right? So you're a blue belt, you're a blue belt. Which one, which blue belt is better? Yes, there are going to be some that have more experience than others. But if you have someone that's, you know, more athletic, they could overwhelm that technique because, again, they have we're not talking about someone who has no technique. We're talking about people that do have a skill set and are complementing it with, you know, strength, speed, or mobility. Because someone who's very flexible is very difficult to submit because they can bend in all these different directions. So it's a skill set in itself. Now, you have a lot of people like, well, you're just strong and that's why you're getting it. Well, you're just flexible. So I'm not going to apologize for being strong. But you have a lot of debate on that as well. Like, oh, he's just strength. Well, you still have to have skill set or not. Jiu-jitsu is worthless because anyone stronger can win. So that argument fails. I'd say more in a competitive manner. I mean, being stronger I don't find any negative part in being stronger in life. So I don't think it's going to make every aspect of your life better. So I would always encourage it. But if you're just in jiu-jitsu, do you need to? No. The first thing I would tell people is clean up your diet. That would be the very first thing. Because no matter what type of weight training, doesn't matter what type of sport you're into, if you eat like shit, you're going to perform like shit. I mean, if I put vinegar oil and, you know, and vinegar and oil in my gas tank, you know, I'm not going to get very far in my car. So if you're constantly, you know, stuffing your face with McDonald's and you're wondering why you can't do good at jiu-jitsu, well, there's your first solution. But weight training, not unless you're like competitive and you have the time, I would always advise it, but I don't feel it's like necessary to develop a skill set. I mean, I know guys that have been doing jiu-jitsu that are like longer than me and never lifted, but they're in great shape. They really are. Because I mean, if you're actually training hard, while you're in your facility, that's a lot because that's cardio, cardiovascular, and endurance. You're doing, aerobic activity, you're doing anaerobic activity, and for a long duration. So for weight loss or for health, yes, it's a kind of like a one-stop shop skill set, getting back in shape, but it won't change your diet.
Fascinating stuff, folks. It doesn't seem like Al and I can ever talk under 2 hours for some reason. Every time we get together, it's at least a 2-hour conversation. Again, folks, go to combatbasedtexas.com, combatbasedtexas.com. Alan, thank you so much again for doing this.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. It's a great seeing you. You look great. Hopefully everybody in here enjoyed the conversation as much as I did and learned just as much as I did. Check out combatbasedtexas.com. And folks, you know what? Again, if you've never been in combat or never trained with anybody, check out, at least get into some martial art program. Check it out. See how you like it. Make sure it's a reputable school too. If you have any questions on that, you can always email us and find out who we recommend in your area. Thank you again for listening. Make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button. You know, we like it.